Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are covering the television series Twin Peaks. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. We are not a spoiler-free podcast. We would love to have you listen, but if you haven't seen the show, don't listen until you watch the entire series.
For those of you that are listening for the first time, our approach towards discussing Twin Peaks is laid back in nature. We are not film geeks. We are just fans like most of you. If you have been enjoying our podcast for a while now, how about leaving us a review at iTunes? You can also follow us on Twitter and like our Facebook page. If you want to contribute to feedback, write to us at noshipnetwork@gmail.com. You can find links to all of the ways you can reach us on our website's contact page at noship.net. And PSA, Steve?
For the remainder of the episode, please stay on the bike.
Okay, so we are discussing Twin Peaks Season 2, Drive with a Dead Girl, written by Scott Frost, directed by Caleb Deschanel. Any thoughts on this episode before we get started?
It's a solid episode. It delivers what it needs to deliver. It's not one of my favorites, but it's not bad at all, in a nutshell. And I'd just like to apologize for all our listeners. I have a really bad chest/head cold right now, so that's why my voice sounds all jacked up.
But you're recovering from it. You're on the recovery.
Yeah, I'm recovering from it, thankfully. But this is why you have the husky version of my voice here. But anyway, thanks for bearing with me, and I should sound back to normal next time.
Okay, so the episode opens with a view of the Palmer House the night of Maddie's murder. You can hear her screams in the background. I think you hear the point where he slams her head into the pitcher, and then you hear a thud.
Yeah.
The scene shifts to the morning after, and Leland is playing golf inside the house. James and Donna arrive to say goodbye to Maddie. Leland says they just missed her and that he just dropped her off at the bus station. Sarah calls for Leland. James and Donna notice a surplus of golf balls and snicker to each other. Leland sees this, and a look of anger quickly transpires across his face. He then tells James and Donna that they could write her instead. They say okay, and they leave. Leland looks into the mirror to adjust his tie, and we see that he is still Bob. Sarah tells Leland to sign them up for Glenn Miller Night at the Club. Leland opens a closet to get his enormous golf bag. He unzips it to put a golf club inside, and we see that Maddie has been stuffed inside it, because we see her hand. He takes the bag out to his car, and he puts it into the trunk.
I thought James and Donna in this scene were kind of funny, because the way that they're looking at Leland is just kind of this mixture of skepticism and kind of like, am I really seeing this humor?
Yeah, you don't really see James often trying to keep himself from cracking up.
Well, this is the third time I've seen him smile in the whole series, I think.
At first, I thought they were smirking to each other because Leland says she was expecting you last night, and that's when they kind of start to look at each other. I'm like, oh, they were doing it last night.
Yeah, I got the strong impression, too, like, oh, nobody was expecting us last night except us.
So just to cap off this scene, Leland begins to whistle when he gets into the driver's seat. He pulls the top down, and he's starting to hum Surrey with the Fringe on Top, which we'll hear him sing later.
This is probably neither here nor there, but just as a we watched Fire Walk with Me recently, and when you look at the front of the Palmer household, in the movie, it's much closer to the street than it looks from the screenshot that you're seeing of
yeah.
it. You know, it looks like there's this big expansive yard, and there's almost nobody on either side kind of thing. You can't really tell, but in Fire Walk with Me, the other houses are pretty close together, and it's, the stairs are fairly steep coming straight down from the porch to the driveway.
Well, it looks more menacing when it has a more isolated look to it. So.
Yeah, and those Amityville windows help.
Yeah. So we see Ben is in jail, and he is visited by his brother, Jerry, who is also acting as his attorney. Jerry first asks if he did it, and Jerry is entirely too cavalier about the whole situation. Ben tells Jerry that Catherine is his only alibi, truly his alibi. Jerry gets excited about bunk beds. They share a memory about a Luis Dombrowski dancing on the hook rug with a flashlight. Jerry asks Lord, what's become of us?
That scene goes on for about a minute and a half too long.
It is a little bit too long, but yeah. I think it's a cool memory, though.
It is a cool memory. I like the scene. I'm not complaining about it, but it felt like they were pushing some filler in there. Like they said, okay, we got to reach a minute length, and we only have this much actual, acting shot, so we're just going to extend this scene of the girl dancing for 2 minutes.
Yeah, especially because, The dancing was like not super inspired.
No, I mean,
So it got really good toward the end where she started like, hooking the flashlight around her neck and stuff.
yeah, getting a little bit creative.
Yeah.
But
No offense, Louise Dombrowski.
oh, definitely
She was
not.
just a little girl. She hadn't learned stripper moves yet.
Yeah, I mean, if I was 10 years old, that totally would have been hot. Especially being older and coming from a more innocent age, I think there was an undertone of that too. That was titillating to younger boys then. Nowadays, with the internet and everything, geez, I can't even imagine what the threshold is.
No idea.
Yeah.
Lucy arrives back from her trip with her sister. Lucy introduces her sister to Hawk.
Kind of awkward with the whole, oh, he's a, what did she call him, a
You
native?
must be the native person I've heard so
Yeah.
much about.
Oh my God.
What's your name? Eagle Eye? Oh, and you must hate us white people so much.
Hawk informs her that some of his best friends are white.
And she picks the most like uncouth, or maybe just everything she says is just you shouldn't say in social gatherings.
Yeah,
It's not polite conversation.
she's like aggressively socially inept.
Yeah. So Harry and Coop are walking the hall of the Great Northern Hotel, and Coop is talking to Diane about how they just left the one-armed man, or at least what's left of him. And he's talking about how he would be a shaman in another culture, another time, except now that he's left to the shadows. And then they encounter Leland, who's dancing in front of the hotel guests, and it made me go, well, what would Leland be
Ooh.
in another culture, another
Yeah.
time?
What would he be?
I'm sure there's an answer to that.
The guy that stands out in front of the village and just kind of like welcomes the invaders in, say, right this way, right this way.
Maybe.
You could take me first.
Soon after, did you any comments about the actual scene before I move on?
I thought it was sad that, Cooper was commenting on the fact that he would have been a shaman in another age or time, but now he's a shoe salesman. And it's just I thought there was just a tiny little microcosm of commentary there about how modern times don't always value things that used to be important
Or things that are different.
or things that are different.
Soon after they see Leland performing in front of the hotel guests, Harry tells Leland that they have arrested Ben for Laura's murder. Leland puts on a show of grief and soon excuses himself. When he rounds the corner, he begins to laugh maniacally under his breath. Cooper, being suspicious, follows where Leland walked off to, and from behind, it appears that Leland could be crying. And also, Leland is standing in front of red curtains.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
It's because of feedback is the reason why I pay, and I'll talk about it when we get there. I want to give credit to it was Tyler who brought this up,
Okay.
but I think as Tyler suggests, it's on purpose, and it's a hint. Well, I don't know if it's a hint. I mean, we already know there's an association between Bob and the Red Curtain, that world.
I kind of feel like between last episode and this episode, and I think next episode, it's kind of being force fed to us that
Yeah.
Bob is there. Every time he passes a mirror, we get another, because before it's kind of left up to the audience's interpretation or their own intelligence or whatever you want to call it to decide or to discern if it's Leland or it's Bob. But they really want you to know that it's Bob. But I mean, I think it would be obvious, but I guess they don't feel that way because they just keep kind of pushing that. And I think that was maybe more of a subtle way to do it, and the less subtle ways were the mirror scenes.
Yeah. I don't mind the mirror scenes though, because.
I don't mind it because they look cool visually.
Yeah, Bob looks pretty menacing.
Yeah, he does. It works on that level, but I just feel like it's something that I don't need to be told.
So Cooper asks Leland if he happens to remember any strange behavior from Ben from the night that Laura was murdered, to please let him know. Leland agrees to do this, and when Cooper exits, Leland begins to laugh to himself again, and then as soon as there's no one to see, he starts to dance.
Which is like a trademarks Twin Peaks move, because we see it in the hallways in the school, and you just Leland's Ray Wise has got some dance moves. He can dance.
Why is it that people who spend a lot of time in the Great Northern dance a lot? Audrey, Leland, Ben, Jerry. You think it's because they're so close to Leland?
Possibly. Maybe there's just something about a cool old hotel like that.
Yeah, maybe. So back at the sheriff's department, Ben gets his finger pricked by Doc Hayward. Jerry attempts to take up for his client. Cooper details Jerry's illustrious career in law. Cooper pulls out Laura's diary and reads the quote about Laura telling the world about Benjamin Horn. Ben loses his cool, and Jerry asks for a moment alone with his brother. Jerry cautions Ben about his temper and warns him that they do not have much going in their favor. He mentions Ben's blood having Laura's fingerprints on it, which is a great line. That's why I wanted to bring it up.
It's an interesting way to look at it. I would have never thought that, you know.
It's just flipping it. It's flipping the I don't know.
Flipping
I don't know how
the
to...
script.
Yeah. Jerry finally gives the best advice as Ben's lawyer and tells him to hire a better lawyer.
A lot of this episode, there's certain parts that I do want to speak to, but a lot of this episode is real self-explanatory.
Yeah.
You know, it's put out there. As far as pieces to kind of cling to and dig out insight from, I think that gets less and less as season two goes on. And this is one of those episodes, you know.
Yeah, I think this is the shortest recap I've ever written in all of my podcasting. It's like it just ended up being that way. So I'm grateful. We probably have our biggest feedback section.
Cool.
Since we started. So
that
will
out,
yeah, take up a lot of the...
We'll actually get the same length out of the podcast.
Yeah. So now Bobby's listening to the tape that he discovered in Leo's boot. Bobby prepares a cassette and a note for Ben. Shelley is having trouble feeding Leo. Shelley asks Bobby what is in the envelope, and he tells her it is their ship. Bobby has high hopes again about the outcome of this new wild endeavor.
Bobby's an idiot. I'm sorry. He's an idiot. He's sitting there transcribing what is being said. I was like, Ben Horn, Leo, you know, and I don't know if that's for our benefit.
No, he doesn't write that.
Or he's saying
he's
it.
Saying that,
okay,
and he says,
saying,
we need to talk.
And then, yeah, we need to talk. Okay, this is why he's an idiot. Because blackmailing Ben Horn is way out of his league.
Yeah.
I mean, Ben's been taken to the cleaners by Catherine, totally set up. You know, and Josie had something to do with that, and, you know, Hank had something to do with that, and there was this big, complicated criminal circle going on here. But even though he's coming out on the losing end of all of that, he's still head and shoulders above anything that Bobby's ever thought about doing as far as criminal endeavors are concerned, and he should just think twice.
And he's probably going to just end, well, I know what's going to happen, so I'm not even thinking. Yeah, you're right.
Just go back to your economics class, Bobby. They miss you.
You really need to finish high
school.
Yeah,
you really need to finish.
So now at the double R, Norma is visited by her mother and her mother's new shady husband. Her mother keeps referring to Hank as Harry, as Henry. I guess that's his proper name. But yeah, so she's kind of a bitch.
Kind of. Oh my God.
But she says about Norma's figure, even though it was a nice thing, she says she looks lovely, but it gives that impression that she was probably always concerned about Norma's figure when she's growing up, you know, and
like she's surprised to see that it's a nice figure, not happy.
It doesn't even have to be surprised. It was just a pressure that was placed on Norma,
okay.
Maybe a worry.
Yeah.
And she probably talked smack about other people who didn't have quote unquote lovely figures, you know.
Every one of her compliments was backhanded and barbed.
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
You know.
Well, she said, no wonder you made this place really nice.
Yeah, because there's a food critic coming. You wouldn't just make your place pretty by itself.
Yeah.
But I guess she wouldn't have because Hank did that. He bought the flowers because of the food critic.
Right. It was all Hank's idea, but still, it's just
she has a point,
nasty
but she's
comment.
Still being a bitch.
Yeah. So at the Great Northern, Mike awakes and says he is close. He's referring to Bob, obviously. Mike asks the nurse to get him a glass of water so he can take out the guard and make his escape.
It's a trap.
Hank arrives at the diner. He has been gone for 48 hours. Norma is pissed. He talks some BS. Norma buys it in the long run, which it's really frustrating to see her going from being how she should feel about him.
Yeah.
And he keeps touching her.
Oh, it was creepy. It was totally creepy because it's just part of that slimy shtick, laying it on thick kind of thing.
Yeah, and it bothers me. I think when I watch it, I read this, and I don't know if this is true, okay? So I had read something online, and I don't remember where I read it online, but it was a quote from Peggy Lipton. And when her and Hank had their first scene together, she wanted to, and this is back in season one, where she had to go to his parole hearing, and they meet in the hallway first.
Yeah, I remember.
And she wanted to rehearse it, and he didn't want to. And so he insisted that they, or he just dropped it and wouldn't do it. And then when they went and acted the actual scene, he grabbed her and pulled her toward him in the scene. And that really upset her. She wasn't expecting it, you know. And so she was angry with him and never liked him after that. And so as an actor, he's still touching her and everything. And that makes it on another level if that's true.
Well, if they actually used the scene that he surprised her in by grabbing her like that, then, the look of disgust on her face was probably authentic.
Well,
But
yeah.
it poisons the chemistry and acting between the two of them for the rest of the series. So it's not worth it.
Well, I mean, it's still bringing up the right emotion that she would need to
Yeah,
muster, but
I
it
guess
doesn't mean
so.
it's
Yeah.
right, though.
But it depends
She's
on
an
what kind of.
actress, so she should be able to act.
Exactly. I was going to say it depends on what kind of actor you are. I mean, some people, if she's the type of actress who needs to honestly dislike somebody before she can dislike them on screen, I don't know if those actually
It
exist.
makes me think of from Exorcist with the gun, where,
Yeah, he got pissed off. That
yeah,
was
you might want to
Father.
explain that.
If anybody's ever seen the movie The Exorcist, if you remember the scene where he's listening to Reagan speaking backwards and alone in the audio lab at the Jesuit school, and then the phone rings and he has a reaction to the phone ringing
A
because he's listening.
startled
He's
reaction.
very, very startled reaction. Well, for years and years, I just thought he just did a great job. But apparently, when they started to do behind the scenes stuff on different versions of The Exorcist on VHS and DVD, it became known that William Friedkin, the director, had actually fired a shotgun at that scene
To elicit that
to
reaction.
elicit that reaction. And it got the reaction that Friedkin wanted. But Jason Miller was pissed off. He was like, "I'm an actor. This is what I do. You don't have to do that. Just tell me how to act and I'll do it."
Yeah, well, William Friedkin did some other shenanigans on that set with Ellen Burstyn. We don't have to talk. We're not doing an Exorcist podcast, but yeah,
If I was an actor, I'd be in a William Friedkin movie, but I would be wary. Bodily
or
harm, psychological damage.
just be prepared and just be game. Just like fuck it.
Yeah, just be down for whatever.
I
Just
might get tossed or
act like you're
something.
gonna, just psych yourself up like you're gonna be in Jackass 4
Yeah.
and then just go to it.
That's a good way to put it. Okay. Right. So to cap off this scene, Norma buys the bullshit from Hank, which is frustrating because I feel like she makes a 180 suddenly.
I also have a problem with the continuity in this scene because with the scene with Cooper and the judge, we learn that every episode represents a day in Twin Peaks ever since Cooper arrived, or ever since Laura was found wrapped in plastic, which would be the same day, I guess. But she says, "You've been gone for 48 hours." He's been absent from the screen for a bit more than two episodes. Am I correct on that?
I don't know. I mean,
I know
this.
we haven't seen him in two episodes. I know that at least.
Yeah.
I believe it's more. It's more like three or four. Because the last time we see him was when
They went and rescued Audrey.
Jean Renault has
Yeah.
him. So that's been a bit.
Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't paying attention, so
I'm
to
not
that
like,
particular thing.
yeah, I'm not raring to poke holes in it or anything, but when they put it out there in your face like that and they give you a prescribed time, and then it clicks in my head like, "Well, wait a minute, I thought every day was an episode." Well, but anyway, we can move on.
So, like I said, Norma buys his bullshit. Norma's mother is also there listening, and she makes her presence known to Hank, and they make dinner plans. So now Harry is watching a woodpecker from his office window when Pete pays a visit. Pete tells Harry that Josie is gone. They talk of how they both loved her, and Harry mentions Josie's assistant. Pete says that no, that was her cousin Johnny, and so on. They both have a bad feeling. Cooper walks in and says that Gerard is missing, and they take off.
When you say Cousin Johnny, it makes me think of Justified.
Oh,
Cousin Johnny.
yeah. They're both bastards.
This is a good scene between Harry and
Pete.
Pete, but
It's just funny how Harry just keeps putting those binoculars up to his eyes during this conversation that's about the woman he loves. It's not till like the whole cousin Johnny thing comes up that he's done putting the binoculars up to his eyes, but it would have been funny if
yeah,
he would have did it again.
he's like, "Yep, it bothers me too." And he just keeps looking at this woodpecker.
Yeah.
I like the interaction between the two of them. And they're two of the more liked characters by me on the show. And I just wish they were talking about anything else besides Josie because now that she's gone, it's like I just want to forget about her. I know she's coming back, but I warned you guys about this earlier. I don't like Josie Packard.
Spare him from Josie. Yeah, nothing to say more, not too much more to say about that scene. Moving on. So Andy encounters Lucy with her sister's baby, and he passes out. I guess he thinks it could possibly be his. I don't know what the
It
hell.
would be just like Andy to think that a pregnancy could happen that fast.
Yeah. So Pete visits Okay. So you have anything else to say about Andy passing out?
No.
Okay. So now we're on to one of my favorite scenes of this episode. Pete visits Ben Horn. He has his own tape player for Ben. The tape is with Catherine on it,
Right.
and she knows that Ben's in prison because she was there when he was arrested. And now she's using it as leverage, the fact that he was with her. And she's saying she wants the mill and the Ghostwood Estates, and she will consider letting him keep his hotel. Pete enjoys the whole show, and after Pete leaves, Ben tears up his room.
Pete even calls him Benji.
Yeah.
That was a nice touch. I like that. Now, the animosity that Pete Martell must feel for Benjamin Horn has to be great because this guy was banging his wife. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? But he was able to get some enjoyment out of her talking on a cassette tape to him. So.
Yeah, we're actually one of our listeners asks us about that in feedback. I do th believe I see animosity from him when he exits. 'Cause when he says she's a caution, and then right after that, you see the animosity on his face when he leaves.
I think he did the whole thing of, in a spirit of meanness, and I loved it.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's definitely
This was the
happening.
adult version of the little kid dancing around going, I have a candy bar and you don't have one, you know, kind
Oh,
of.
for sure.
And it was great.
I mean, yeah, there's enough animosity for him to do that. But what do you think about his and Catherine's relationship, that he could still love her so much to kiss the cassette, knowing.
That's what I was kind of commenting on. I just
Okay.
thought that, like, his animosity towards Benjamin Horn had to be so great that he would side with this woman who's cheated on him, pretended that she was dead, and let him think that she was dead, knowing that he still loved her and everything else.
Yeah, I wonder what the story is there.
I think if Twin Peaks had had a naturally occurring season three and not one 25 years later, I think we would have found out.
Yeah. Leland is driving, singing, and swerving. Cooper and Harry encounter him on the road. They were close to colliding, actually. They pull Leland over. Leland claims he was driving erratically because he was thinking about Ben. He then says he did remember something. He overheard Ben say something about a dairy. When the night that Laura was murdered, he made a phone call. He was speaking angrily, and he said something about a dairy. Leland wants to show Cooper his clubs. Not quite sure what was the plan there from Leland. Thankfully, though, Cooper is called away because they found Gerard.
First thing about this scene is when they start talking to him. I wanted to ask you, okay, this is Bob talking to them now, talking to Cooper, and he's saying he said something about a diary. Now, is this Bob not knowing what a diary is and calling it a diary, or is it him trying to kind of make them say it correctly first so they can trigger their memory of the diary?
Yeah, I think it's a way without, if he were to say diary, it's a little bit too on the nose and
Right. Okay.
could lead back to him. Yeah, he's toying with them
Okay.
knowingly. Well, he in Fire Walk With Me, he was trying to find her diary behind. That's how she discovered him,
So this is just a trick
and then
then.
she saw her dad leave the house after, and that's when she was like, "Oh God, not you, not you,"
Yeah.
and eventually she puts it together that it's her dad, and that's where Bob's like, "Oh, I have to kill her. She knows who I am."
So Bob's a dairy reader.
Yes, he reads dairies.
The second thing is, I am of the opinion that Leland was going to club Cooper over the head if Harry didn't call him back over to the truck. Ill-advised as it may have been, and as careful as Bob has been in his other endeavors that involve murder, that distinctly looked like he was brandishing that club as an actual club.
See, this is one of those rare things that I would say this was purely just to heighten tension, fear from the viewer. It doesn't really make sense as far as like the Bob character is concerned, right?
But we don't really even have to. There's no discussion about whether it made sense or not because it didn't happen. So it's
Yeah.
all speculation. So they're off the hook for it.
Yeah, true. Or maybe it does make sense. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, he wants to show Cooper this club, and it's in the bag with her body. All he'd have to do is poke his head around and see it, and then he'd be committed to killing Cooper or trying to.
So next scene is between Andy, Lucy, and Gwen. Andy is trying to tell Lucy that his sperms are vital, that he is the father, or that he thinks he's the father, and Lucy's, what does she say?
She's very noncommittal. She hasn't really told him about Dick Tremaine yet. Or he knows about Dick Tremaine, but he doesn't know that he could possibly be the father as well.
Yeah, and they are interrupted by Gwen because Gwen's mad. And
Gwen is about as likable a character as Josie in my book.
I like Josie better.
Wow.
At the sheriff's department, they have Mike sniff at Ben. Jerry demands that they either charge his client or let him go. Harry then charges Ben. Ben yells that Harry is finished in this town. Cooper pulls Harry outside the room and tells him he does not think that Ben killed Laura Palmer. Harry is frustrated. Cooper says, "You're right. This is your backyard."
Well, he's right because Truman brings up a bunch of good points. He's like, this is the only person we have hard evidence on. We have A, B, C, and D. And then it's just kind of like, you know, it's not any of the mumbo jumbo. There's no dwarves, giants, or whatever else.
And after he lists all that stuff, and if you look at Cooper for a second, you just kind of start to think, yeah.
You know, Harry's job, what he gets paid for, is to look at the law through the lens of reality. He has to arrest Leland because, not Leland, he has to arrest Ben Horn because that's where the evidence points. That's what you have to do as a lawman, you know, and Cooper's actually correct, but his methods, he realizes his methods don't stand up to scientific scrutiny.
At dinner with Norma and her mother, Norma's mother is annoying about food. She just seems like a drag to bring out to eat. Norma and her mother get up to go to the restroom, and this leaves Hank and Ernie together so we can learn that they know each other from prison. We learn that he was in jail for thieving to support a gambling problem that he claims to have overcame. The women come back, and Hank proposes a toast to the newlyweds. Norma knows something is up between the two men.
This is one of those very soap opera-y, Twin Peaks-y sort of not really significant plot lines that are going on.
So Hank is basically blackmailing Ernie now.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's doing to him what he was claiming was happening to him and why he was missing for 48 hours.
Yeah, because he was given the spiel about no matter how much he tries to run from his past, there's always someone there who can run faster. And
yeah,
you know.
And look what he's doing.
Exactly. He's doing the exact same thing.
Dickhead.
That's a good point. That's a good point. See, so there is little bits of insight to be found even in some of the, the barren wastelands.
More mundane scenes. So Cooper talks to Diane in his hotel room. He believes he is close to figuring out the murder, but the last steps are the most difficult and the darkest. Audrey pays him a visit and asks about her dad. She also wants Cooper to know that nothing happened at One Eye Jack's. Cooper receives a phone call and tells Audrey to go to her room and to lock the door. Harry and Cooper make their way to where Maddie's body has been found. Harry tells Cooper it is Maddie Ferguson. End of episode.
Cheryl Lee has got to just have an aversion to, you know, white plastic to this day.
Plastic allergy.
And when she goes shopping, she's probably to say, paper or plastic? Paper! Paper, goddammit!
Yeah, when David Lynch directed Cheryl Lee in plastic, he had a more artistic approach to it. She looked a lot more beautiful.
Yeah.
But maybe this is supposed to be a cold, hard look at it compared to David Lynch. I don't know. This is Caleb Deschanel.
You could also view it maybe as, you know, he was trying to establish a palette when he first showed her wrapped in plastic.
Yeah, that's true.
And then now this is just another piece.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't have to have the dramatic visual impact.
All right, so our first piece of feedback actually is going to be commenting on the last episode we covered, which is Lonely Souls.
Okay.
And it's from Daniel, and he wrote this on Facebook, and we also have more feedback from him about the current episode. But so let's just go over this really quickly. So Daniel says, just to follow up, I don't think there's a continuity gaffe with Shelley's waitressing job because the actual line she says in episode 13 is, "I have to quit my job, Bobby. How am I going to make it on this?" So presumably, she just now gets around to doing it in this episode. About Laura's picture on Ben's desk. In the shooting script for Fire Walk With Me, Leland gets agitated about this at Johnny Horn's birthday party, asking him confrontationally why he doesn't have a picture of Audrey, which sets Sylvia off as well. And in private, Ben tells Laura about this, and she says that he's always been jealous of you. It's too bad that scene was never shot. You also mentioned confusion over the Philip/Mike divide. I think he had more anxiety and seemed agitated because while Mike is almost magnanimous, the host body, Gerard, is becoming weaker the longer they withhold the drug that he has seemingly become dependent on, perhaps. Thanks for another great episode. Especially enjoy the insightful and humorous analysis of James.
As far as Shelley talking to Norma, that was my mistake, and I own up to it.
Well, I had agreed with you. I thought I had remembered it being past tense.
I thought so too. I thought it was past tense, but it was actually present slash future tense that she was talking. So that is my mistake, and you're right. That does not represent a continuity gaffe. So thank you for pointing that out.
And then what he was saying about Laura's picture. We talked a lot about Laura's picture on his desk, and I had wrote back to Daniel on Facebook, and I actually had, when we were preparing to cover that episode, I purposely looked closer at the picture that was facing outward on his desk, and it's a picture of Audrey. So I thought it was interesting, and I forgot to mention this on that podcast, but I thought it was interesting that he has this outward representation where
he's all about family.
He's all about his daughter, and then you have this darker side that, if you were to me, it represented the duality in the show where you have the apparent, what's apparent about a person versus what's barely hidden.
Yeah, the surface and just below.
Right. So, and then, yes, and it's interesting he also brings up Mike. So we have another listener who talks about what we were discussing about Mike, but I think you could be right about Gerard becoming weaker the longer they withhold the drug. With our body and chemistry, our bodies are always trying to seek equilibrium. And before it, you know, when you take something away from it, you have that time in between before it does reach equilibrium again. Just like when you quit cigarettes or anything of that ilk, it causes a reaction in your body, causes you to act strange, and you know it can very well be a good explanation for the way he's acting.
I can definitely jive with it. That makes the most sense to me.
So now, in the order of how we received these emails is how I'm going to read these.
All right.
So we have Nico. He's writing to us for the first time, and Nico says, "Hi, I'm from Finland, and your podcast is one of the several that accompany me on my fourth Twin Peaks rewatch. This time I've decided to really delve into the mythos and discussion within the Twin Peaks community. I really appreciate your in-depth approach and free-roaming speculation. It has been both helpful and enjoyable. Thank you a lot, and please keep it up. I've just managed to catch up to your recent episodes, so I want to quickly address some points while they are still relevant." So I'm just going to get to Nico's points about the actual episode. I'm going to skip a couple things here. Okay, so he says, "In the Demons recap, you lamented about Audrey mumbling in her restless sleep when brought to the bookhouse. While you felt sad about her childhood with neglecting father, I've always linked it with the most recent and most traumatizing events. I think Daddy, Can You See Me? Can You Catch Me? Refers directly to the horrific scene at the One-Eyed Jack's where Ben tried to catch her and tried to see her face."
What do you think of that?
I can see how that would be. In ways, it might be triply. It could be a tri-layer because you have what's actually happened. You could have what you could assume happened in childhood. You can also have the fact that we're heavily trying to point or try to lead the viewer that Ben Horn was the killer, and to say, "Daddy," or "Can you catch me?" to remind you of, "I'll catch you in my death bag."
Okay. Because the one thing you don't want to think about is her being the new girl and going, "Daddy, can you catch me?" Because that's not the desired outcome for anybody. You know, so that's the one thing that I'm thinking of when I hear that.
And yeah, I'm just like, I see what you're saying.
Wait a minute. You know.
Yeah, I don't think she was playful.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's the best way to say it. Yeah, but I can definitely jive with the other interpretations of that. And he said Nico is from, I responded to him,
Finland.
Finland. And he speaks American better than I do.
So in the latest episode, Lonely Souls, you pointed out how distressed Mike seemed compared to his usual composition. I've interpreted it as a natural reaction of him being in control for so long. I don't find it strange, really. I guess I've assumed that Mike's spirit doesn't somehow fit well with its vessel, Philip Gerard's body, and it rejects it, like certain chemicals do each other. They just don't function as well as Leland and Bob, for instance. So they're like oil and vinegar.
Yeah. I brought up, when I wrote Nico back, I brought up a point that he made me think of actually while I was reading his letter. And that was, maybe there's a different relationship between the host bodies and the inhabiting spirits when it's something like Mike and Philip Gerard, when it is a host and an embodied or a you know an inhabiting spirit, and then you have Leland and Bob, which is just outright possession. Bob just comes in and says, "I'm in control now," and that's the end of it. There might be more of a sort of like, I don't know, symbiosis maybe with the other ones, because yeah, it's not as malignant. Obviously, Bob's possession is malignant. It almost borders on what you would refer to as demonic possession.
But Gerard's taking medication to just suppress Mike, so I don't think it's an agreement.
Point. That's a good point, too. But I could almost see that as him wanting to be able to suppress him when he wants to. But maybe not. Maybe he's just trying to get rid of him altogether.
Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely food for thought.
What I find is very interesting about all this is a lot of this has to do with possession, like I've said before, but there's a religious element that's completely left out of it, and it's kind of a really neat way to look at it. So instead of an exorcism, you're doing this with chemicals. It's a very realistic and almost psychology-based way to approach this type of thing.
Yeah, it is, and it also, but there's that, but at the same time, it seems older, like more like animus, like style religion, and then
I can see what you're saying.
But very primitive, and then also more modern as far as like aliens. So to me, it's like a combination with modern psychology too. So he goes on about Mike, and he says, "I also think Mike experiences physical world as a foreign place to him, and is fatigued and bewildered easily just by operating directly in it for too long. It too should be noted that he is basically being used for information and is not taken into consideration like a human would. Then again, it would be strange that he still has inhabited Gerard's body for apparently a long time and even has torn an arm off of it." Yeah, I agree with, I think I've even said something along those lines, at least as far as how he communicates and can be overstimulated in a way by the world. So I do agree with that he can get fatigued and bewildered easily.
It does seem that way. I do agree with that point. It would be like the equivalent of, you know, going into a one of those old style diving suits or something, and then going however many fathoms under the sea.
To adapt.
It's a whole other world. And I mean, you're ostensibly, it's the same thing because you're existing in this form, but it would have to be a very different experience. What I was going to say is, like, there was the part where he was sniffing around Leland like a dog.
Yeah.
Because you said sniffing, and it made me think of that.
Yeah.
And it's almost like they said, take him back to the Great Northern. Like somebody, like Hawk had his leash, you know, and they were saying, all right, take him back. He's just this, like, animal to be used. You know, he's a tracking
hound
or something.
He's their canine.
Yeah, he's a canine unit.
So back with Nico, he's still talking about Mike, and he says, anyway, the way he is off reminds me about certain curiosity that I don't think has been ever addressed in the story itself. It's that Mike presents himself in Cooper's dream in the form of his host, Gerard. It serves as a tool for exciting story development when they hunt for the one-armed man, but is different from the way other spirits are presented. We've seen what Bob looks like. We can suspect that the old servant is inhabited by the giant. The question is, how does Mike's spirit body look like? You know, this got me thinking. This is like my favorite part of his letter.
What are you thinking?
It's way off base.
Let's hear it out with it.
Way off base, Cooper.
Intriguing.
Only because it can't be it, but it was fun to think. And the only reason why, and I know I'm forcing it, but because Laura has her dream, the 25-year later dream.
Yeah.
And she thinks possibly Cooper's Mike. And also when what's David Bowie's character?
I can't remember his name.
When he comes in, he's like, who do you think this is here?
Who do you suppose this is?
Yeah. It's just fun to think. Why not?
That scene you're talking about where they read the page out of Laura's diary is at the beginning of next episode, actually.
Yes.
We'll get to that when we get to it. Mm-hmm. But that is interesting. I don't know.
I know it's off base, but it's fun to think.
It's just
a new way to think of it and see if there's anything else that falls in line. So, not afraid to throw it out there. We're wildly speculative. That's what we do.
But it's some really good points that Nico brings up.
Yes, and thank you so much for writing, Nico. So our next one is from Daniel, and he says, hey, Em and Steve, this episode is interesting because suddenly our perspective aligns more with Leland than with Cooper, who was previously our infallible, trusty guide. Here are all the things we once found harmless, fun, or endearing about Leland now take on a sinister edge because we now know what lies underneath that charming facade. We know who the killer is, but have to wait for the characters to catch up. I almost wish that Leland's murder of Maddie had come after all the stuff with Ben in these episodes, just to draw out the red herring and make the reveal even more of a surprise.
Yeah, I agree with that strongly, actually, because I don't feel like there's any tension to the scenes with him in prison or with him being questioned by Cooper and Truman and Hawk and, you know, or even Philip Gerard or anything. It's kind of, they're not bad scenes per se. They're not badly acted, but they're toothless in the sense of not really being able to draw the audience into a belief that this character is in trouble somehow.
Yeah, it makes it more fun for us as the viewer, but I guess as far as the story is concerned and where they're trying to take the story, it makes more sense for Cooper to figure out that he's on the wrong path.
Yeah, that's true too. I mean,
Yeah. 'Cause at some point he has to figure out that he's not, it's not Ben. You know, he what
right.
he's I don't know.
He knows that it's not Ben, but he just has to find the way to prove it to everybody
Right.
else.
So Daniel goes on, in that first shot, it almost feels like the show symbolically takes a step backward from the uncompromising darkness and brutality of the last one by showing the screams and violence at a safe distance outside the walls of the house. I do like the Palmer house from the series better than the one used in the film, though, because it looks isolated enough to where you could believe neighbors wouldn't hear anything. So,
Exactly.
haha.
Exactly. I agree with the point too about a step back from the brutality because I think I mentioned it on our recap of the last episode, but I felt like that might have been a little bit too much for people, a little bit too in your face, a little bit too brutal. And this almost, I agree with Daniel wholeheartedly here because this seems like a concerted effort to like pull that back to where it's manageable because the only real like blood and guts you see in this episode is a quick sneak peek of Maddie's face inside the golf bag and then
Her hand.
her hand and then what else? There was one other little thing or when she's unwrapped at the end of the episode, which, you know, isn't bloody or anything like that, but that's the only stuff that's really like that would unnerve somebody who had those frail type sensibilities. But I could see the last episode really making people get up and turn the TV off, especially in 1990. Or at least say, I'm not watching this show ever again.
That's a way to, I guess, maybe to pull back as far as you don't want it to be a constant hitting the
Right.
same note, right? So you
Or
kind of,
it's just like dynamics in music.
that's what I'm trying.
Yeah.
I was thinking Pixies again, but yes, dynamics in
You have your
music.
peaks and valleys, and it's time for a valley.
So Leland's story to, so Daniel goes on with Leland's story to James and Donna about dropping Maddie off at the bus station should be immediately suspicious. Last episode, Maddie told Sarah and Leland she would be driving back to Missoula, so she must have a car. And at the beginning of episode 13, we even see Maddie driving away from Donna and James at Harold's house. So what did Leland do with Maddie's car?
I'm thinking that he, off screen, obviously, at some point, he drove it into that pond that Maddie and James were sitting in front of when they said their goodbyes to each other.
I honestly have not thought anything about this, so I can't answer that
It has
question.
crossed my mind before, and that's the only thing that I've come up with. But I didn't think about it too long because it's one of those things to where, well, if the show creators aren't going to spend too much time on it, then I'm probably not going to because there's more to digest and devour over here. But, that's what I always thought happened because it's like, yeah, she obviously had a car. She was an adult. She had her own life and an apartment and a job, what we've already talked about. So what did happen to her car? It's obviously not there, you know, which is kind of weird because there doesn't seem to be a garage, obviously, on the Palmer estate. But, you know, James and Donna come up there asking for her anyway when they don't see her car out there.
Yeah, I don't know. So Daniel goes on with, so what in the world is with Louise Dombrowski's dance on the hook rug? It makes me laugh, but it goes on so long.
Yeah, we brought this up to you earlier. Yeah.
It's a cool memory. I like that it's in there and it's inserted in there. It's a way to give a lighter tone or for a minute or 5 minutes, however long it
However long
lasts.
it was, time becomes subjective in the Twin Peaks world. I'll say this, as far as that sounds good for a in-universe explanation. They're just indulging in this memory. The brothers haven't been around each other for a while, so we're getting a Ben and Jerry moment. Okay, great.
Back to their innocence.
But in the real world, it feels like directorial indulgence. And I'm just guessing that that kid is like Emily Deschanel or something like that.
No, she's related to somebody else in the movie business. I'm not sure who, but
Oh,
somebody
okay.
else.
Well, they filmed that whole scene, and by God, they were going to use that whole scene, and that's what they did. You know, somebody was just like, "This scene is getting used. I'm going to have my daughter, niece, cousin, whatever she is, she's going to be in it, and she's going to be in it for the whole goddamn 2 minutes."
I don't know, Daniel. I agree that it does go on too long. But what in the world is with this scene? I think it just lightens the episode a little bit and brings us back to when they were innocent, maybe.
I guess there's a good ironic juxtaposition here, because they're bringing us back to innocence while they're both sitting in a jail cell.
Yeah.
So there's something there.
So Daniel says it is so bizarre that neither Harry nor Cooper had the decency to tell Leland that Jacques did not, in fact, kill his Laura, even after arresting him for murdering the guy, since he clearly appears shocked to learn this here. Yeah, I thought the same thing. It seemed like he would have learned that information already because they had, but maybe because you kind of have to keep that kind of information close to your chest sometimes when you're out there investigating and just in case to see what else will crop up or. You know,
Well,
maybe there weren't, maybe it was some sort of investigative strategy not to reveal that information.
I think the fact that the investigation went on at all after Jacques was dead should have been all of the information that Leland needed to know that Jacques wasn't the killer. Because once you've caught the killer and then killed the killer, there's nothing more to do. Everything's closed. You know what I mean? And somebody would come to him and give him closure about that and say, like, okay, you're still going to jail, but at least you killed the guy who killed your daughter. So that, I mean, to me, that was a given and an obvious, but it does seem strange that they didn't explicitly tell him that. Maybe they didn't want to rub it in his face, like, hey, in your grief over your dead daughter, you killed the guy who you thought did her in, but this was just some goon.
Yeah, and do you, this is not what Daniel's asking, but do you think that Bob was convincing as a surprised and grieving Leland to find out Ben was involved? And
I did. I did. I think Ray Wise played that really well.
so you think Bob was convincing? I know Leland or Ray Wise is convincing as playing Bob, as playing Leland, but.
I think he's convincing when he has a chance to compose himself, when he's turned away from whoever he's talking to, and then he slips. But as long as we as the audience see his slip, like when he's coming down the steps, you know, to talk to James and Donna. And then, you know, when he has his back towards Cooper, he does a little slip too. But once he turns around to talk to him, yes, I would say that yes, I think he's convincing.
Well, 'cause Cooper was suspicious.
But Cooper's an excellent lawman.
I know, and he's connected, but to whatever those frequencies are. But I think he was suspicious because it seems to me that if you were told that the person you killed, or you just found out the person you killed wasn't the murderer, you would be upset about that. And he just glazes on by that.
I didn't think about that. That's a good point. Yeah,
So
that would be,
you mean the
see,
guy I killed was innocent?
so Cooper's lawman instincts probably just shot red flags high into the air right there. They're like, wait a minute.
It's probably more likely the frequency, but yeah, I think it's
Both.
both.
Yeah,
Yeah.
both. The practical side and the spiritual side.
So Daniel then says, Jerry's line, your blood may have Laura's fingerprints on it, is either a brilliant way to draw attention to the fact that Jerry doesn't have a clue or nonsensical script writing that made it to air like Lucas's Kessel Run and 12 parsecs.
Yes, the classic 12 parsecs Kessel Run. Lucas will never live that down. Although if Disney mangles Star Wars, then he won't have to. But you're right. It's
You should probably explain that.
well, 12 parsecs. Parsecs are, if I'm not mistaken, they're a unit of space, not time, right? It's a unit of distance,
Okay.
not time. So that would be like saying I made the Kessel Run in 12 miles. It's like the Kessel Run is a finite distance, so why would you tell me how many units of distance you made it in?
Yeah, so if it's 12 miles, anybody would make it in 12
Right.
miles.
So if parsecs was a measure of time, you could be bragging. It'd be saying like you ran a 2 minute mile.
Right.
So that's why it's foolish of Han
Instead of I
Solo
ran a
to
two
have,
mile.
yeah, you know what I'm saying. But so that's why it was silly of him to say that, but you know.
Okay.
I think though that this was just Jerry's personality coming to the forefront. He's kind of, if he's not talking about food or women or beer, or maybe, some chicanery up at One Eye Jack's. I think his bag of euphemisms tends to get mixed.
I like the line. It just sounds like something that would come from like a snarky detective book or something. I like it.
It does have that feel to it, but then when you examine it, it makes no sense.
No, it's not. There's no reality to that. Nobody's blood would have anybody's fingerprints on it, but it
Yeah.
sounds really cool. Daniel says, "Nothing says professional like mustard stains on your blackmail envelope to the town tycoon. Shelley needs to stop falling for Bobby's bullshit schemes already." Agreed.
Second that.
Yeah. And Daniel goes on, "Once again, while Hawk is out probably fighting crime, Harry is bird watching on the clock."
Good fucking point. Jesus Christ, what are the taxpayers in Twin Peaks doing?
Weirdly, okay, Daniel says, "Weirdly, Pete doesn't seem bothered at all by the fact that Catherine was cheating on him behind his back with Ben when he plays that tape in the jail." We discussed
Yeah, we
this.
just, yeah, he, that's what I'm saying. That's why I think his animosity towards Horn is greater than his peevishness towards the fact that they had an affair.
I think Pete has come to some sort of acceptance for Catherine, and he's comfortable within that marriage and secure despite.
Yeah, I think he still has residual emotions, but I really get the impression that they haven't shared a bedroom in many years.
Oh, yeah. But he definitely has a lot of respect for her.
True, yeah.
So Daniel goes on, "After his failure last episode, it's good to see Cooper getting back on track. Listening to Mike when he says that Bob is not with Ben and trying to follow the clues from the spirit world that will lead to the actual truth of the case rather than trusting circumstantial evidence and more deduction alone." So yes, Cooper is back to listening to the denizens and he's starting to get somewhere again. Yes.
Well, that's the kind of mind that he has,
Right.
and like you get that clear demarcation between him and Harry in the scene where Harry is saying, "I have to arrest, Leland Palmer," or I keep saying that, "I have to arrest Benjamin Horn," because
Well,
that's where the evidence points.
that's where he's at his best. So we didn't really talk about it. Actually, we didn't talk about this when we were going over the recap, but Cooper was humming the song that.
Leland was humming or singing.
Yes. What does that say? He's tuned into that frequency.
Right.
And that's where he needs to put his
You
focus.
have to use the tools that you're given.
Daniel says, "Thinking that Hank and Ernie were prison lovers is the only way I can smile at their scenes."
Hadn't thought of that, Daniel, but thanks for that image. I'm already sick. Now I gotta think about that.
And Daniel says, "I still find myself getting drawn into the relationship between Cooper and Audrey, even though I know any possibility for it would be soon written out of the show. Those two characters just have such a great resonance on screen together. It's a real shame." Sherilyn Fenn has been quite open in interviews about her placing the blame for that aborted story arc firmly at the feet of Laura Flynn Boyle's jealous pressure on McLaughlin, who in turn gave the ultimatum to Lynch and Frost. So finally, Steve, we're talking about
We
this.
have avoided talking about this till now.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because Daniel's bringing it up or because you were just
I
waiting for
just
somebody
want
to bring it up.
it I just want it to come up organically, and this is the best way right here.
Okay. All right. Let's throw all the cards on the table. What do you know?
Well, yeah, I know that Sherilyn Fenn has been very open that she's blamed Laura Flynn Boyle. I know that Kyle MacLachlan within the last couple of years has corroborated what he said back then, that he felt that Cooper was too old and for Audrey, and that it was unlikely that his character would have a relationship with a person who was in high school. He never, as far as I know, said, "My girlfriend's making me do this," or whatever. Nothing from Laura Flynn Boyle. I mean, I doubt she would ever say anything. I think Laura Flynn Boyle was only like 19 at the time. I think Sherilyn Fenn was around 25. I think McLaughlin was in his 30s, which is interesting. But
So you have Kyle MacLachlan, who is in his 30s having a relationship with a 19-year-old, saying that his character, who he plays, who is in his 30s, would be improper to have a relationship with an 18-year-old.
which there's nothing wrong with that,
No, there's
because
not.
I think I actually agree with that. I do think that Cooper would not date a high schooler.
I agree with that. I agree with that. But there's a lot of things that these characters do that I wouldn't either put my stamp of approval on or think that the writers would actually ever have them do, and they end up doing it anyway. So a relationship between Cooper and Audrey could have been in the cards, but it got stopped for some reason. What we have to speculate on, or what it's up to us to speculate on, is whatever that reason was it big enough for the writing team to go, okay, that's a valid enough reason for us to not do this? Because if Laura Flynn Boyle was putting her foot down and saying, no, this isn't going to happen, what were they going to suffer if she left the show?
Yeah, I'm not sure who had leverage and where. I believe my understanding is that McLaughlin is the one who was the one that was insistent. I mean, it happened because there was an actual argument that was overheard between him and Frost. Like, they actually raised their voices and everything. So McLaughlin was the one who had the most power, obviously. He's the star of the show. He's the one who put his foot down about the whole scenario. If it's true that Laura Flynn Boyle was the one pressuring him into that, I don't really know.
I would have liked to optimally, you know, have Twin Peaks just gone on for however many more seasons, you know, that it was going to go on for and not get canceled. But if there was ever going to be a love affair between the two of them, I would have liked to have seen it kind of happen organically and unfold over the course of a couple more seasons, perhaps, and have her age a couple of years and come out of her schoolgirl crush hero worship phase of him and start to see him as a human being and really like him as who he was, not as this archetype. Because the archetype of who he was makes him inaccessible to her. And you have to get past that whole her wanting him just because he is inaccessible. You have to make them meet as two people.
Right.
So
yeah, she still has some growing up to do.
Yeah, yeah. But I do agree that it is not in Agent Dale Cooper's character to date an 18-year-old. You know, he will date his partner's wife, but that's another story. So he's not a man of impeccable moral fortitude, but hey, you know, there's situations, right?
Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever get answers about that. And then, you know, it doesn't really bother me, honestly.
Jealousy is always an ugly thing, but I mean, given how Hollywood tends to work, I mean, we all know the story about that movie, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. Apparently, from what I understand, I don't follow Us magazine or gossip or anything like that, but from what I've gathered,
it's permeated no matter what.
Brad Pitt was with Jennifer Aniston before that, and then he does a movie with Angelina Jolie, and he's with her ever since.
Yeah.
Now, if I was a girl and Kyle MacLachlan was my boyfriend, I wouldn't want him doing love scenes with Sherilyn Fenn. That would be a no-no. So I kind of don't blame Laura Flynn Boyle, but especially if you're 19 years old, I completely understand the position. But having said that, you can always think of Larry David when I say, having said that, I don't think that anybody should do anything out of personal feelings that are to the detriment of the show. Whether it's Laura Flynn Boyle doing something out of jealousy, whether it's Kyle MacLachlan having a perhaps erroneous view of what his character could or should or shouldn't do, the writers write these people. And I think once you act them, you kind of feel a certain ownership of that character. But you have to realize that there's a boss, you know, and you only your limitations of or not your limitations, but your playground is only ever going to be so big of what you can do with that character. And I think that's only fair.
Currently, that playground expands when you get into third season, because I read something that David Lynch said somewhere where first season, actors work for you. Like, if you're the director, the creator of the show. Second season, it's like this mutual partnership. Third season, they've gotten so much more famous and everything at this point. You're working for them.
God,
being the director.
Horrible.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so now we have another new writer into our podcast, and his name is Joel. And he says, hey, Stephen M., fair warning, long feedback ahead. Feel free to be selective in what you share on the air. I've been enjoying your podcast, which I just caught up thanks to Daniel. So he shared it on a Twin Peaks site. Cool. Thanks,
awesome,
Daniel.
Awesome, Daniel. Cool.
Yeah.
Right on.
So Joel says, we're now at the exact halfway point of the series, which is a bummer, as it would have been nice to continue feedback on the previous episodes. Still, what an episode this is. There are so many different topics that could be discussed, but I'll save some of them for later. Weaker season 2 episodes to hopefully liven up the conversation. There's only so much to be said about little Nikki and the mayor's love triangle. Yes, yes.
Amen,
help us
brother.
With those.
Amen. We're really going to need your help coming up here in the next few months with these casts that we're going to do.
Yeah. So he says, I would like to hear you two talk about the killer's reveal, specifically whether it was a mistake for the show to end the mystery at this point, and if so, when or even if it should have occurred. For me, it's complicated. Dramatically speaking, the reveal, and especially the way too neat wrap up in a few episodes, stops the show dead in its tracks. I think the post-reveal storylines could have been handled better, but even so, answering who killed Laura Palmer feels like a conclusion to the story begun by the pilot. At the same time, the decision to end the mystery paves the way for what are, to me, the highest points of Twin Peaks. Specifically, the reveal episode itself, the finale, and the film, much as I love season one, those points are the essentials of the saga to me. I also think the forced reveal pushed Lynch in a new direction as an artist, leading to Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, etc. More on that another time. So it's like this killed the show, but maybe the show had to die to achieve those heights. David Lynch's position is pretty clear. He says that it was a mistake, implies that maybe there never should have been a solution at all. But while Lynch always blames the network, Mark Frost pushed for the reveal, as his comments then and now show. I think ABC's pressure is a bit of a red herring in that sense, important as it no doubt was. Frost has always stated that for him, Twin Peaks was the story of a whole town, and that while the mystery was a great entry into it, it was beginning to obscure the bigger picture. Many interviews from 1990 reveal him to be worried about audience burnout due to the intensity of the big question, and emphasizing there's much more to the show than Laura Palmer. He's changed his mind since, but even a few years after the show was over, he was saying that the extension of the mystery was a sticking point between him and Lynch. So to me, the interesting part of this is not so much the mechanics of the storytelling, but what it reveals about Lynch's and Frost's differing thematic priorities. Lynch seems absorbed in the hunt for Laura's secrets, leading to his heavy involvement in the first part of season two before disappearing, and then eventually to Fire Walk With Me. Frost likes the sprawling nature of the town's intrigue. Indeed, the book he's publishing this year is called The Secret Lives of Twin Peaks, with Laura herself just as a gateway device. There's a lot of overlap in their collaboration too, but I think their creative differences explain many of the confusing things about the show and also, in a roundabout way, some of its strengths. There's much more to analyze on the Lynch Frost topic, which I'll save for the episodes emphasizing the mythology and Cooper's backstory. For now, do you think Lynch is right about Laura's mystery being the sun of the Twin Peaks solar system around which everything else should revolve? Do you think there was a way to build off the reveal to keep some story continuity going? Or did the series need to completely end this line and attempt to start a whole new plot, which is basically what it ended up doing? Looking forward to the next episode.
Here's my take on it. I've always felt that, and it's good that we're reading this particular feedback letter right now, because the opening episode of the pilot episode opens with Laura Palmer wrapped in plastic. This episode ends with Maddie
Maddie.
Ferguson wrapped in plastic. So you have goalposts. The mystery is solved. It's still going to be a few episodes yet before the denizens of Twin Peaks know who it was, but we know who it was, and we've known for a little while. And well, not for a little while. We knew last episode, if we didn't already know. I've always felt kind of two minds. I think at this point we're entering a post-Laura Palmer Twin Peaks. She has less and less to do with what's going on, and everything else that was peripheral now becomes a focus. And so I think it works sometimes, and it doesn't work other times. But I think that's more due to a function of the strength of the writing process at any given point. So when you have when you have Lynch and Frost heavily involved in it, it works. When they're absent and they're off doing their movies, Wild at Heart or whatever else at the time, it tends to be a little bit thin. But I've always felt that Twin Peaks is an intriguing place filled with these great characters, and Laura Palmer was just our gateway. She was our gateway drug into it, like I think you mentioned, like something almost verbatim like that. So I'm kind of wandering, so I'll wrap it up. But to answer the question as succinctly as possible, I don't think that Twin Peaks fails after the reveal. I think that when Twin Peaks does fail, it fails because the writing process isn't held up to the same standards as it was held up to in season one and the first part of season two. But I think that Twin Peaks as a place and the things that go on there and the interpersonal relationships between the characters are more than enough to sustain an interesting, insightful, and intriguing show.
Well, I can only talk about what I know and then what appeals to me as far as answering this question. I think, and I've been reading about Twin Peaks off and on For a
For a
long
while,
yeah,
yeah.
for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the days where, in the 90s when every website you went to had music on it. You know what I mean? Like,
Oh, yeah,
I
I
remember
remember
these
that.
old websites I would go to, and I don't even know if half the information I read on there was valid.
Yeah, the interweb was a much more muddy place,
Well, I
you
mean,
know.
as far as validity, I don't think there's anything, better now, but
Well, there
it's
are
just there's just
more.
more sources
There's
now.
more places to cross-reference what you learn,
That's true.
you know.
So I think I remember hearing that Mark Frost did push for the reveal, but I think I forgot about that, and I've been more, as of with the information I've gotten, more recent history is that Mark Frost and David Lynch were on the same page with that. So I don't know if I'm remembering that my previous,
Yeah.
anyway. So I'm gonna quit wandering here too, but I think they do work well together, like Steve does. I know what it's like to be on a project with somebody and butt heads, but you can still create magic after. So even
Definitely.
if you have a conflicting approach, you can still make amazing things.
She's not talking about me, by the way,
I'm
just so you know.
not talking about you. As far as and I feel like I'm not answering this very well. Let me see. My understanding, it was ABC who was pressuring. At least recent information definitely
Yeah.
points to that. And
It was stuff on the Blu-ray, wasn't it?
there's stuff on the Blu-ray. It's in the oral histories.
Yeah.
It's I believe in the Wrapped in Plastic book. It's my understanding why the opening sequence in Fire Walk With Me, you have that axe crashing through the television set. It's David Lynch's commentary on the television culture in general. He's very frustrated after that whole experience. I'm not sure, rightfully so. I mean, he's the one who wandered off to go film Wild at Heart. As great as Wild at Heart is, but he did neglect Twin Peaks in the
You can't
process.
walk away from your horse and get mad when it goes into the woods.
Your
You
horse?
horse.
Oh, your horse.
Your horse. I suppose you could walk away from your whores as well, and if they wander into the woods, you can't get mad at them. Jeez, where is your mind tonight? Well, I'll let.
Well, let me finish with
Okay, I need.
answering some stuff here because that's all. And as far as how the show ended up like going in season two, what was appealing to me about the show was having this darkness with a touch of quirkiness, a touch of lightheartedness from time to time, done in a clever way, even mocking the whole soap opera format. So it kind of goes off into this really silly, chaotic world later. It has like way too many tangents, it seems like, and
Definitely.
it gets lost in its own woods, so to speak. So, what were you gonna say?
Well, that just to riff off of that, that's what the whole post Laura Palmer thing is, because you had all these characters that were centered around Laura Palmer.
Yeah, anchored to her.
Yeah, anchored to her. That's a good way to put it. And then she's dead, and her murder is solved, and these people are still there. They're still alive. They're still in the town. They still need to have a story told about them, whether because of real world considerations like contracts, or because they're fan favorites, or for whatever reason, they're still there. So that's why you get James Hurley riding off into the woods to go have a liaison with some crazy woman.
That's gonna be fun.
So, you know, that's some of the downfall of season two. But you know, as far as Lynch not ever wanting the reveal to happen, I kind of question how long you can keep a show going pre-orgasm, if that may. How long, you know, to use a term from Orange is the New Black, how long can you edge a plot? You know, it really though. That not all right. That was silly, but
That's funny.
to answer the or to ask this question, how long would it have been feasible? Everybody says, yeah, you know, they told us who killed Laura Palmer too soon. All right, let's say they never did, and the show went on for 5 or 6 seasons. By the end of it, you would be wanting to pull your hair out.
They would have eventually have revealed it. They weren't ready to do it then.
And then what would they have done afterwards? So I guess if they weren't ready to reveal, they didn't know what they were going to be ready to do afterwards. So I guess that's valid, but
It would have been interesting to just to see. I mean, how would it have I mean, I think most places they strive to bring you that sort of conclusion at some point.
We're huge Farscape fans, so it's no stranger to us whenever the real world kind of impinges on, the artistic world and makes decisions happen before they're ready to actually artistically happen. It's never a good thing.
Happens to all the good shows. Well, Joel, I hope we answered those well. I feel kind of
Your letter was really great, and it was really well structured and articulated. So I feel like my meandering response to it was a little bit weak, but hopefully I touched on all the points that you brought up.
Same here. I hope I did too. I feel like I cheated you, Joel, but thank you for writing, and please keep writing to us. We'll work harder next time.
We're going to need all of you guys in the episodes and weeks and months to come. It's going to get rough.
All right, we have one more piece of feedback, and it's from Tyler. We haven't heard from Tyler in
What's
a
up,
while.
Tyler?
He says, "Hey guys, I haven't written in the show in a couple weeks, but this one is one of my favorite non-Lynch episodes, so I just had to. This one's a long one, so feel free to just pick out the good parts of this. And as ever, it's full of my opinions and unverifiable speculation," which is, you're right at home with that.
That's what we do.
Yes. And he says, "I love the foreboding music playing over the opening shot of the house. Great reminder of what happened last episode. That scene with Leland makes me wonder if he realizes he's killed again. It seems as though the closer he gets to an actual kill, the lines between Bob and Leland blur a little bit more than normal and probably stay that way for a while afterwards. This would really explain a lot of Fire Walk With Me's ambiguity. Maddie's corpse in the golf bag is so surreal since he's talking evening plans with Sarah at the same time. The jail scene is my favorite Ben and Jerry moment, which since so maybe I should stop there and then we can talk about Ben. Okay. So any comments on his
Well, he's saying how the line he's saying how the line is blurred between Bob and Leland right before he starts to kill, but he was Leland this whole time. Or he was Bob this whole
Yeah,
time.
he was.
So
I'm convinced that he was Bob this whole time. I think he's been Bob since that moment he bent his head back and that light shined over his face when he was killing Maddie. Like he's fully Bob since. When I say above his face, there was a light that hovered over his head above his face because his head was like reared back.
Right, and this was in the previous episode, and that's when
Right.
he really just got enraged and killed her.
That's when he turned into Bob, like fully. So now he talks about Tyler talks about Ben. Now he says the jail scene is my favorite Ben and Jerry moment since Brie and Butter on Baguettes. Jerry is a supremely terrible lawyer. I could do better. The flashback they have of Louise Dabrowski dancing on the hook rug with a flashlight is so funny to me because it shows they've been slime balls since they were little kids. Of course they were. Ha ha.
It's funny because some of us interpret this as innocent,
Right.
and Tyler's interpreting it as them just one more instance of them being slime balls. But they are two kids watching a girl dance in a room.
And Ben does own one-eyed Jacks.
There you go. So, I mean, maybe you can look back and kind of, history can predict future behavior. I guess we're only thinking it was innocent because, she has a skirt and socks on and a sweater, and she's not, dressed like a face card. Or something, I don't know.
Is she the one who corrupted them?
It seems like she's a little bit older.
Is she their babysitter?
Oh, never thought of that.
So he goes on and he says, "Gwen is so terrible. She beats Lucy at her own shtick. Maddie gets a lot of flack for her doppelganger status, but I think Gwen is the worst of the lookalikes. But for what it's worth, she may be a glimpse into the future for Lucy as a mother and wife. Poor Andy."
Oh, yeah. Poor Andy, indeed.
We could do with a little less Gwen.
Yeah, it is. I didn't really think of it until, Tyler, until you put it into that framework. She kind of does steal Lucy's stick, and Lucy doesn't really act like Lucy in this episode.
I'm gonna start calling her Gwendol.
Gwendol? Like Grendel?
Yes.
Very nice.
And Tyler asks, "Any significance to Leland standing in front of red curtains, laughing and crying in the Great Northern?" I think so, and I think you are right. You drew my attention to that, Tyler. So good job. I'm sure everybody else noticed, but me up until this episode. Dale has to play good cop and bad cop in the interrogation scene. What is the sheriff's department doing? I wanted to see more Harry, but Cooper does a lovely job and makes quick work of Jerry's credibility. I know that Vivian and the food critic subplot is okay. Do you anything you want to say about Cooper with Jerry or anything that you hadn't already said?
No, I mean, we touched on it earlier. That's the thing about some of the feedbacks. If like, if we've already, you know, if we get
Yeah.
to another letter and we've already talked about it, I don't want to shortchange people who write us, you know, but I mean, but I don't want to reiterate stuff that you've already listened to on the podcast. I reiterate enough anyway.
What is the sheriff's department doing? Bird watching.
Bird
Bird
watching,
watching.
exactly. Hawk is doing the real policing.
Yeah. Truman is watching Hawk. He's bird watching.
He's watching Hawk work.
Yeah.
Donuts.
Tyler says, I know that Vivian and the food critic subplot is not a favorite among fans, but I don't mind it a bit. I can relate to Norma in this scene because I grew up in the South and have plenty of family members like Vivian. But my favorite thing about Norma in this episode is that she finally gives Hank some sass. He deserves it. I always thought of Ed and Norma as a sort of emotional anchor of Twin Peaks, so it's good to see her start to stand up for herself. She's always given to others, but learns to put her needs first. Yeah, I agree with you, Tyler, but then she seems to like make a 180 and all of a sudden she's back on his team again, which really frustrated me, mostly because he kept touching her.
And
But
I almost have to wonder if the fact that
her mom was there.
she's doing that because of pressure from her mom, like, okay, we're gonna have to pretend like we're a happy family because I don't want to have one more failing in my mother's eyes.
Yeah, because her mom seems to like him despite the fact that he spent some time in jail.
Yeah, I
The
don't.
level of expectation that she aims at Norma, she doesn't aim at him. Tyler says, I'm glad that Harry and Pete have their short scene together since they're really the only people who care about Josie. It seems appropriate that they leave the scene disillusioned.
Yes, they are the only people who care about Josie. Let's move on.
But he says they leave the scene disillusioned. Disillusioned by Josie, I think he means. Like, or
Yeah.
about Josie.
Yeah, that, well, because they had conflicting information and they were
Yeah.
like, she's lying to both of us.
Yeah. Okay, Tyler says Leland's driving is so great. His car is beautiful and his singing combined with his terrible driving seem perfectly sinister. Harry's timing is impeccable in regards to the golf clubs. There's no way clubbing Dale would have worked out for Bob though, right? Right. I agree. Yeah, it's such a weird idea to think if he would have followed through with it, like how would the rest of the story gone? Like would he have actually killed Cooper? Would he have just hurt him? Would he have made him an imbecile.
It's tough to say, but I think that they considered all of that before they actually executed the scene and they left it the way it was on purpose. You're right. It was just done to heighten tension.
Leland's driving is great, though. I think, because, I don't want to kill anybody, but I think Bob is supposed to be, he's like this pleasure seeker, right? In a
Oh,
way.
yeah.
So the way he's driving and singing back and forth, I mean, I would never do that on the road, but I can see how that would be super enjoyable if you could,
Oh yeah, it's an embodiment of that carefree spirit
Yeah.
of just not giving a crap whether you hit a little kid running across the road or not.
When Cooper is recording his, okay, this next thing Tyler says I really like. He says, when Cooper is recording his tape, he mentions a starless night. I did a little Googling and found that it was considered bad luck by sailors because it would be much easier to get lost without stars to guide you, and that it is sometimes believed to be a sign that a hidden truth will reveal itself. Sounds about right.
That's a good point. I did not make that connection. I wouldn't have expected myself to make that connection, but
Kudos to you for Googling that, too.
yeah, I would say that that is a really good point because that's exactly what happens later on in the episode, you know, and that's where you have that fault line between him and Harry, you know, because Harry has to do the actual lawman work and Coop is like, well, I got to go down this path. And there's more on that on next episode, like people telling him to do that. I think it was specifically Hawk and Albert.
Tyler says the way Cooper warns Audrey makes me wonder if he already suspects her as a potential victim. Is this foreshadowing? We know that in season one they had planned Audrey instead of Annie as the final victim of the show. Could it be the writers hinting around? At this point, was Audrey still planned to be attacked? That's all I've got for this episode, but one more thing before I sign off. In my last email, I wrote about the Tremonts being a guide to Laura's salvation. I didn't explain this very well. What I meant was that they were luring her into taking her Black Lodge trials like Cooper does in the finale. Hawk says that you have to confront your shadow self in the Black Lodge before you can get to the White Lodge, and I think that's what their plan was. But as any creeped out teen would do, she took the painting off her wall before this happened. And he says, "Let a smile be your umbrella." And he signs off with Tyler. Thanks,
Nice.
Tyler. So I guess let's talk about Audrey being the original victim at the end of the season. Any commentary on that?
I had never heard that before, or at least if I did, I don't remember.
I have. I mean, you haven't read any of the literature out there,
No,
so
nothing. I
yeah.
read Dale Cooper, My Life, My Tapes. That's the only expanded universe Twin Peaks stuff I've ever read.
Well, originally they had planned Audrey to be Cooper's love interest, so it would make sense to have him be in the situation where his love interest would be the one at stake, right? Because he would have to be dealing with that again because of his
Yeah.
past. So Annie ends up being the one filling that.
How is Annie? I really don't have too much to say about Audrey, because it's one of those things where it's an aborted plot line,
It's an aborted plot line, and Audrey's storyline I don't really like.
When Billy Zane shows up and everything.
Yeah, and then she ends up at the bank chaining herself.
Yeah.
Or, I guess this goes back to what Joel, was it Joel that was asking us about it? Oh no, it was Daniel, actually. It was Daniel. So her storyline, because of what Daniel was saying earlier, took a different path because apparently there was issue, so Audrey could not be the love interest of Agent Dale Cooper, and so they had to do something different for this character who already, gained a lot of the love from the audience, and you can't just get rid of her, so you got to keep
Right.
her around, and so we ended up her with.
We have to have stories for these characters, and
Right,
that's how we
right.
get Billy Zane and
Yeah.
chains to bank vaults.
Exactly.
Hooray. I had something to say about the last point he made, but I forgot what it was.
It's possible that Tyler, that they might have been still thinking about Audrey was going to be attacked. It does seem like they were still trying to push the relationship between Cooper and Audrey. The fact that Cooper answered the door with his shirt open, which is such a Rico Suave move. I don't know. It's just, especially for Cooper. I mean, most people would button up their shirt before they open the door, just in general,
Yeah, I
I would
probably would.
think. So, that was done for effect and to create a sexual tension between the two characters. But then I think also, I think it raised the question, is there sexual tension? And then when you see Audrey react to his open-shirtedness, not with a sexual response, but with, oh, was that where you were shot? Like, so maybe that was their beginning of them putting that nail into that coffin of that idea of them together.
I could see that.
So I'm not sure if that's a good answer to that. So if they were still planning on her being attacked, I'm not really quite sure, but I think this is hinting that, or they're starting to pull away from the whole idea of them together, at least at this point. And so what he said about the Tremonds being a guide to Laura's salvation, the test to get, because there are some ideas that you have to present when you present yourself to the Black Lodge.
Oh yeah. What I was gonna say about that was, could you imagine how scary it would be to confront an evil version of yourself? That would be horrific. That's like my worst nightmare.
I've actually had a nightmare like that.
Like a doppelganger Steve would just scare the crap out of me because everybody has dark thoughts. So I could imagine my darkest thoughts I've ever had and then just multiply them or extrapolate them out. And this person has them as their de facto mode. They're just evil. That,
Yeah. I back when I was living in Sonoma and I had a lot of personal issues, I had a dream where I was wrestling myself, and it was nothing like the Zoolander
It has
outtakes
to be
of.
something like, I can't imagine it any different than
No,
that.
it was really, really scary. But that's that.
Dancing with myself.
So, okay, that's interesting to think that the Tremonds are guides to lull somebody into to confront your shadow self in the Black Lodge. It's interesting. So, why would they be around? Why would Donna encounter them? Did they know that? Maybe that explains why they said, I am a lonely soul. They knew that Harold was going to die, and so they were there to help him, guide him through this particular path as well.
So they're kind of like a
They hover
embodiment.
around all the doomed people.
They're like the they're Karen, you know, the Styx River boatman that takes you across to the land of the dead.
And Chet Daniels, before he disappears in Fire Walk With Me, that their trailer was on top of the area because he reaches down for a ring that's like a mound underneath their trailer. So somehow they exist and appear before people who are about to, who are doomed.
And didn't the
what
the
about
caretaker
Donna, though? Huh.
Didn't the caretaker say like, yeah, the Tremonts lived here,
and they're also known as the Chalfonts.
And then the people before them were named the Tremonts as
yeah.
well. So it's almost like a concentrated power there. Got a telephone here.
It's got a ring to it. That's interesting. I like that idea, Tyler. I'm gonna think on that some more.
Thanks for this feedback, you guys. We feel like we're just kind of blundering through it. You know, we get these really well thought out, articulated letters that are really well done, bring up great points and awesome insight, and then we're just kind of like, yeah, yeah, that's cool.
I know.
But I think the important part is that we read it to the other listeners, and you know, it just
yeah.
makes the whole process more enjoyable. Though it's
yeah, I'm glad we have smart people writing in, so we can make our podcast better. Thank you guys, and we hope to hear from more of you guys. And once again, you can write to us at noship.net. We have a contact page that will direct you to all our various links. All right, that's it. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.